Only a Game is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
College football is tailgating on fall Saturdays, tumbling cheerleaders, and, of course, the rumble and crash of armored bodies on the gridiron. But according to Kurt Edward Kemper, college football is also a player in the drama of the American psyche. In College Football and American Culture in the Cold War Era, Professor Kemper explores, among other things, how some anti-communists saw dangerous leftist tendencies in anybody who wondered out loud whether perhaps football was being overemphasized on college campuses. When I had the opportunity to speak with Professor Kemper, who teaches history at Dakota State University, I began our conversation by asking him about a passage in the official Rose Bowl literature from 1962, wherein somebody wrote, quote, "So long as there is a tournament of roses, so long as there is a Rose Bowl game, there will be a free United States." Why, I asked Professor Kemper, did that particular bowl game assume special significance in the early 60s?
Because it was the preeminent bowl game. It was the oldest bowl game. It was the first bowl game to have nationwide radio. It was the first bowl game to eventually have television. It was also in Southern California, which for a good half a century was an Edenic-like place for people. It was something the West has always been more imagined than real to many. And the Rose Bowl was, in some respects, the frontier of college football in that regard.
You write that in their 1961 attempts to create a game between two worthy opponents, the stewards of the Rose Bowl inadvertently laid bare the anxieties, conflicts, and paradoxes of post-war American society. How did you come to that conclusion?
Painfully. It took me a while, but I eventually came to realize that for all of the ever-present understanding in American life that the Cold War was something that was necessary, I kept finding these nuggets of evidence that suggested we weren't entirely sure of where this was going to lead us. We were constantly inundated with demands for material greatness, and famously in Nixon's kitchen debate with Khrushchev, where he essentially said that we were going to win the Cold War because we had better appliances than the Soviets did. But at the same time, underneath that is this fear of what all of this material greatness is going to lead us, because ever since the onset of industrialization, there's been this underlying tenor of American culture where we've been wary of softness, that material abundance is going to somehow create weakness. And these kinds of anxieties were ever present. We were anxious, for example, about being the leader of the free world at a time when we were practicing segregation and damn embarrassed about it. And so football revealed itself to me one day as this sense of a little bit of everything to everyone. Critics, opponents, friends and enemies, everybody found in football something during the 50s and 60s that they could latch onto.
It was the convenient antithesis to softness, I gather.
It was. It was, of course, obviously rugged, aggressive, manly, all these things that we have ascribed to the game ever since the 1890s. But the game also was uniquely American at a time when we were desperately attempting to assert our differences with the Soviets. This wasn't just a game that no one else played. This is a game that no one else understood, that no one else even could have played if they'd wanted to.
Given the difficulty that the people responsible for choosing opponents, two teams to play each other in the Rose Bowl in 1962, faced, give me a rough idea of how they finally came up with two teams and some of the hurdles they had to get over.
Well, the selection process dragged on almost interminably in the fall of 1961. In its initial phase, that was to the liking of Tom Hamilton, who is the executive director of the West Coast Conference, which is now the Pac-10, but at the time it was called the Athletic Association of Western Universities, a rather cumbersome mouthful. And Hamilton wanted, by his own admission, to restore the preeminence of the Rose Bowl as the dominant college football game. What he did not foresee was the meat of my book, which is the fact that all of these campuses would have to face these issues that really had nothing to do with football. The argument at Ohio State over the role of the Cold War. At Alabama and LSU, the question was segregation and whether they either A, would play segregated teams, and B, under what circumstances and to what cultural meanings. And then the likely opponent was going to be UCLA, And then the students there, including members of the football team, threatened to boycott the game. Eventually, they settled on Minnesota and UCLA. UCLA was opposed largely because they did not want to play a segregated team, either Alabama or LSU. And once it became apparent that Alabama and LSU were not going to come, then the boycott effort on UCLA's campus fell apart, and then they happily played Minnesota, although it didn't turn out well for the Bruins. They got thumped. But Minnesota proves a bit of an interesting side story, because they had actually voted against the contract year after year. And the reason for that was because the way the contract was worded, it said that the champion of the Big Ten would be required to play in the Rose Bowl. And for many at Minnesota and on other Big Ten campuses, this undermined the concept of faculty control. And so when Minnesota was able to win a concession that changed the wording of the contract from the champion of the conference or other representative, then that gave the faculty at Minnesota the ability to turn down the invitation if they so chose, which they never have.
One of the teams that might have gone to the Rose Bowl in 1962 was the team from Ohio State University, but the faculty objected to the football team's participation. Why?
They were anxious about, in the short run, the standing and the role of Ohio State as an academy itself. But in the long run, they were anxious about Cold War priorities. You have to realize that in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the future of college athletics was still in play in terms of whether we were going to continue to pursue this mega commercialized, professionalized model, or whether we were going to make a U-turn and try to embrace amateur principles. There were significant reform efforts in the period. There were significant scandals that were embarrassing to the extreme. And there were many hopes that this was a turning point. These were not individuals who necessarily felt that Woody Hayes was the Antichrist, that, you know, he took his lunch at the faculty club with many of them. They liked him. It wasn't just that they wanted to throw out all the athletes. It was they wanted to try to assert the priorities at a time that they really perceived to be the Republic's hour of need, of hour of maximum danger.
To what extent did it matter that that 1962 Rose Bowl game, which did not include Ohio State but was between Minnesota and UCLA, to what extent did it matter that it was a boring game?
In my book, not at all. In fact, other than the first sentence of the introduction where I basically note that it was a boring game, I don't discuss the game itself at all. It's really all of the run-up to the game that is so significant, because in sports history, frequently, the games themselves are almost never what we're really interested in. It's what they reveal about American culture and American society that is so intriguing to us. And so the process in which the teams were selected got us into issues of the role of the Cold War in the academy and segregation in the South and free speech. All of those issues came out well before the game and were really unrelated to the game itself.
You quote an Ivy League coach during the Cold War period as saying, "Football is our best defense against communism." How exactly did that logic work on the East Coast?
Well, irrespective of geography, many Americans during the period came to see the game as representative of an American way of life. Now, we seldom use that term to mean the same thing. We all sort of have different concepts of what an American way of life is. In general, I would say it's notions of capitalism and democracy and religious liberty. But if you push a little harder, we all end up having our own sense of what exactly that means. And in the 40s and 50s and early 60s, football came to mean a generally, reinforcing, benevolent interpretation of the American way of life. And so for people to make claims that football was somehow a defense against communism was to say that it was distinctly American. It was un-Soviet. It's what makes us better than them, quote unquote.
It's a little bit ironic that an Ivy League coach should have said that. Did it follow naturally that colleges and universities that de-emphasized football as the Ivy League did drew suspicion upon themselves?
Oh, absolutely. The Ivy League became, as I note in the book, I call them the favorite whipping boy of football supporters during the period. Because the Ivy League chose to distance themselves from the big-time trappings of the game, at a time in which many Americans came to identify football as I said, distinctly American, it was a short leap for many then to label the Ivy League as being soft on communism. And of course, this is at a time when those connections are already being made by people like Senator McCarthy, for example, and by the political actions of the day, the Alger Hiss case, the Owen Lattimore case, issues where many were anxious about what was happening at the Ivy League campuses in terms of what were perceived to be faculty sympathies towards communism or left-leaning political sympathies.
You write that in the 50s and 60s, college football, and I'm quoting again now, contained enough components of force, violence, and deprivation to reassure Americans. What precisely did they need to be reassured about?
Well, in the short run, that we were better than the Soviets at a time when there seemed to be abundant evidence that America in the post-World War II years was not a society in ascendance, but one in decline. J. Edgar Hoover made his famous comment that one out of every five children under the age of 18 would be a juvenile delinquent at one point. Billy Graham had his crusades in the 50s where he was concerned about moral decline amongst the youth. So there was this concern that the youth of America were declining. There was also concern about adults, physical fitness tests. All of these things caused many Americans to think, perhaps that we weren't up to the task of confronting the Soviets after all.
So evidence that you had not declined morally would be being on the college football team. And then there's another quote in there about somebody who says, I would rather have my son be on the football team than graduate Phi Beta Kappa.
Yeah, that was Biggie Munn, the head coach at Michigan State. I think when we look at each of these quotes, and when I first came across them, I sort of chuckled and thought, well, those really don't mean anything because they're just sort of toss-away quotes that in and of themselves have no context. But as I ran across them literally by the handfuls, they revealed to me not so much that Biggie Munn maybe necessarily really did want his son to be a, you know, an All-American as opposed to a Phi Beta Kappa, but the presumption that those comments could be made and there would be a universal chuckle of agreement suggested to me that many Americans found in football, accepted in the game, these a priori benevolences that really needed no further explanation, that needed no context. It marked a cultural acceptance of football that previously only baseball had enjoyed. You didn't need to explain that football was so antithetical to the communists, that football was going to help us win the Cold War, because so many people had begun to accept on their own terms and in their own meetings that football was good, that football was uniquely American.
Does the force, violence, and deprivation of college football that you mention serve the same purpose now as it did 40 years ago, or do we not need it to serve that purpose since today our wars are hot rather than cold?
Well, I don't know if we ever needed it. I think in terms of a cultural understanding, we don't ascribe the same meanings to the game for a host of reasons, not the least of which is we have incredibly distanced the population in general from our armed forces and our military commitment. I do think that many people still see in football distinctive American traits. The game is still something that is reinforcing, that says something positive about American life.
Kurt Kemper is a professor of history at Dakota State University, and he's the author of College Football and American Culture in the Cold War Era, published by University of Illinois Press. He spoke to me from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Professor Kemper, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill.
My conversation with Kurt Kemper about his book, College Football and American Culture in the Cold War Era, will be featured in this week's program. I'll also be talking with Tim Kirchin about the hopeful and the hopeless now that we've reached Major League Baseball's home stretch. We'll celebrate the contributions of Eunice Kennedy Shriver to the Special Olympics. I'll have a story about the most accomplished female soccer player in the world as she and her teammates attempt to win the first WPS championship. And we'll learn about the racing bicycle couriers as they stage their championship in Boston, where riding a bike is a risky proposition even when you aren't in a hurry. So join us, and remember, you can always listen to the program at onlyagame.org.